Welcome to the Practical Futurist Podcast, a bi-weekly show all about the near-term future with practical advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and practical futurist, Andrew Grill.
Welcome to episode 5 of season 2 of the Practical Futurist podcast. Today I'm joined by a longtime collaborator and friend, Andy Lopata, who describes himself as an author, professional speaker, and professional relationship strategist. He's also someone who helps businesses and individuals build, nurture, and leverage professional relationships. His clients have included the BBC, Wembley Stadium, HSB Securities, Weller, and GlaxoSmithKline. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what does a professional relationship strategist actually do?
I guess the answer is pretty much in the title, but I'll work with organisations and individuals within those organisations to help them look at how the professional relationships they build can charge their business and charge their career. If you look at most of the challenges and the skill sets that leaders and successful business people focus on, they're powered by relationships. Whether you're looking at change management, leadership in itself, business growth, you can list challenges, and pretty much every one could be made easier and better if you have the right connections with the right people in the right place and strong relationships with them. But we tend to leave that to chance. And what I try and do is encourage those people to think about them more strategically.
Well, if you're asking someone to do something that will involve a change or is uncomfortable, you want to be asked by someone that you actually like. You've got to like them in that, yes, I would do that for you because we have a relationship. At some point down the track, I may need to ask you to do something, and it's a quid pro quo.
Something really struck me back in January. I was speaking at an event for event organisers. And before my talk, I listened to the opening plenary session. And it was a lady called Nalan Emre, who's the COO of IMEX, which is one of the biggest event organisers in the world. They run, you'll know IMEX, they run events for 15,000, 20,000 people in Las Vegas and in Frankfurt. And Nalan Emre was talking about how they're making their events sustainable. And she had three key points, and the second point was collaboration. And she, throughout the talk, she talked about the different stakeholders she needed to have on board in order to make the event sustainable. And I, as soon as I had the chance, I rushed out and I got to the slides and I created a brand new slide for my presentation, listing all those stakeholders. And the point I made is, you had in there, it started with the team. But she didn't say the team. It wasn't the IMEX team. It was the finance team, the sales team, the delivery team. So you had all the teams within IMEX. You had all the different suppliers. So you had the people that build exhibition stands, the transportation on ground level.
The cleaners.
The cleaners, the caterers. You had the clients and bringing the clients on the journey. And I listed about 12 or 15 off, just from my notes from the talk. And my opening to my presentation that morning, and it's become the opening to this new presentation now anyway, was what's the one thing that's going to make your life easier in bringing all of those stakeholders forward? And it's professional relationships, it's strong relationships. And I had a quote from Nalan Emre at the end of that, which said, if you have your partners on board, you multiply your impact. So that's what I try and help people do.
And I think people don't recognize the power of professional relationships. We'll go into this in more detail, but we think networking is, okay, I've connected with you on LinkedIn, so what? And there's a whole story around that. You actually, for years, were known as Mr. Network, but you've started to move away from this. So is networking now a dirty word?
Networking's always been a dirty word. And I've always said that if I could find the replacement for it, then I'd make my fortune. It's not as dirty a word as it used to be. 2008 changed that. When people started losing their jobs, LinkedIn activity, in my experience, absolutely spiked. People were maybe on it, but weren't really using it. 2008, 2009, I saw a sea change as people either were looking for a new job or felt their jobs were under threat. And I saw a massive change in the way people engage with networking from that point, to the point where before the crash, I was at an event for women in technology. I did the bravest thing I've ever done in my life, and I've parachuted and rap jumped and so on, abseiled. I put my hand up and asked a question of a panel at an event called Women in Technology, where there were 199 women in the room and one man, and I wasn't even in technology. Mm. But I asked the panel about the difference for a woman to a man networking in a corporate space. Because at the time I was moving from running a network for small businesses and knowing that I wanted to move into working with corporates. And one by one, they shot me down. They said, you know, we don't do that. We don't have time to go to the pub after work. We don't manipulate. Everything that they said about networking was negative, even though everything I would define networking as was represented in the advice they gave in their presentations. 1 year, 2 years later, I was at an event for another women's event. It was a European Professional Women's Network. And one of the speakers asked 150 women in the audience this time, how many of you think networking is important to your career? Every hand went up. That was a huge change in a short period of time. So I don't think networking is as dirty a word as it was in the, you know, before 2008. Having said that, it's still misperceived, misunderstood, undervalued. It's still seen as a soft skill. It's seen as a sales tool. It's seen something for junior levels. And it's all of those things and none of those things. And the reason for my shift from a focus on networking to a focus on professional relationships, of which networking forms a part, is that I was getting pigeonholed into how to work a room. You know, my friend Susan Rowan wrote the book How to Work a Room probably 30 years ago now. It's a word, it's a phrase that's really stuck in the popular vernacular. And we do need to know how to make the most of networking events. But it's a tiny percentage of what I do. And when you talk about professional relationships, conferences and events are just one tool. And I've been preaching that message for a long time, but I think it took the shift away from talking about networking and into talking about relationships for people to get that. Then if you want to build professional relationships, you can look at how networking events and conferences sit into your toolkit.
You mentioned Susan's book, How to Work a Room, and everyone uses that phrase. And some people might think they're actually brilliant at working a room, but some people also don't even know why they're in the room in the first place.
Well, that's the phrase I've always used. You know, there's no point knowing how to work a room if you don't know why you're in the room in the first place. I've always talked about networking strategy before networking skills. So when clients have come and said, could you give us a talk on how to work a room or networking skills? I've said, well, I can, but what's the strategy? And I would often sort of say, well, let's do a talk on networking strategy first and then look at the skills. Because otherwise, you know, you get a lot of people, even if they're more confident in that environment, they're still not going to want to be there because they don't see the value.
So take me through, you meet someone and maybe it's an interaction you have at an event, and we actually met, I think, at an IBM event probably five or
yes,
six
we
years
did,
ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take me through what you advise clients to do next to build this relationship beyond just connecting.
It's follow up. Mm. You know, it's so simple and yet it's missed by so many people. You've got what I call 9-to-5 networkers, and you know, it's not 9-to-5, but they think I'm networking between 6 and 8 because those are the hours of that event, and
yes,
then I'll go back to everything else I do. And they go around and give out cards and collect cards, and that's done. And I think what's come into that now is let's connect on LinkedIn here and now, and we think mm-hmm. it's done. I'm very resistant to that because I think you know there are several reasons, but that doesn't give you an opportunity to follow up later. You're taking one of those touch point opportunities away.
Yes, that's true.
One of the things that I'm talking about a lot now with the new presentations and workshops that I've got on professional relationships is the structure of a network and what a network actually looks like. And it's something I've talked about for a while, but I've developed my theories on it. So I think when you say to most people, what does your network look like? If they visualize anything, they'll visualize a box with people in. So you get the classic question, how many people have you got in your network? And we end up with a Dunbar number, which is 150, which is actually a misunderstood figure, because that's how many people that you could remember at any one time rather than how many people you have in your network, or Girard's law, which is 250, both of which I've always had issues with. But the biggest problem with both and that question is that it assumes a network is a finite resource. Networks aren't a box with people in. They're not finite. I picture network as if you picture the side section of an onion, so lots of circles, getting bigger and bigger, growing outwards. So we're familiar with the term your inner circle, but we never think about the other circles outside that. So I've developed a model which has seven stages of professional relationship. When you meet someone at an event, they are at stage one, the outer circle. And I've termed that recognize. And so if I met you at that IBM event, we had a conversation. Now we followed up with each other and we built the relationship over time. If that hadn't have happened, if I had seen you 2 weeks, 3 weeks later at another event, you probably would have recognized me. Yes. That would mean I'm in your network. But 6 months later, yeah. Probably not. So we want to get from stage one recognized to stage two no. So that means you see me across the room, and instead of thinking, oh, I met that guy at an event 3 weeks ago, you're thinking, that's Andy Lopata. Mm-hmm. He specializes in professional relationships. You know me. Then you start building the relationship deeper and deeper. So you've got recognize, know, like, trust. And it's interesting you said about you need to like someone to want to support them, do business with them. And there is this argument that you might not necessarily like them. And by the way, when I say you might not like them, I'm not saying you dislike them, but you might not have a strong rapport. Mm-hmm. But you trust them. Yes. And I think that we will do business with people and we will support people we trust, but we don't necessarily have a rapport with. But so you've got recognize, know, like, trust, support. And by support, I mean you pick up the phone to me. I did it to you yesterday. I emailed you and said, Andrew, would you help me with something?
And of course I will, because we have a professional
absolutely.
Relationship.
And yeah. We're at that support level.
Yes.
In fact, we've gone beyond that.
Yeah.
But we've reached that support level. And the support is I reach out to you and you say, of course. The next stage is advocate or champion, which means I don't have to reach out. You're out there talking about me anyway. And then friend.
But our professional and personal relationship has developed. I mean, we went to the rugby together. You said, I've got some free tickets. And I thought that was incredibly generous. And we enjoyed some rugby together. I remember also we actually had lunch at the hospital club before your book. And I shared some very personal information.
Yes.
And I felt really good about doing that. I felt very vulnerable. Mm. And the way you responded was beyond a business network. It was someone who is another human being who actually cared about that. So when you pick up the phone or write me an email, I don't even have to think about would I even consider helping Andy, because there is a deep value in two human beings. And yes, that may manifest itself in a relationship that can be monetized down the track. But I like dealing with people who actually get what I'm about and take the time. And I think that's really hard, because you're right, these 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 networkers, they're often saying, well, what's in it for me? My friend J. Kelly Hoey in the States had this great quote, and it embellishes one we all know. It's not what you know. It's not who you know. It's who knows what you know. Because you will know someone who knows someone who knows about that. But as long as you know what I can do, you can then advocate on my behalf. And I think that's really important. A tip I do when I meet someone, and I put them in my organizer, there's a note section, no matter what app you use. And I put a note about where I met them and something about something they said. And I've got to tell you, it's come back to helped me years later. I remember I was at a conference in the US and one of our IBM suppliers came into the room. He'd booked a meeting with me as an executive. And he said to me, you don't remember me, do you? And I went, actually, I do. We were both in a guest lecture in Sydney on this date and you spoke about that. And he said, how did you know that? I wrote it down. I actually care about other human beings. And I think simple things like that means when you see someone again, you can recall what you thought when you met them.
Yeah, I'm terrible with process, even though it's what I teach. And I try and apply as much as possible. What I do is if someone comes up to me and says, you don't remember me, do you? I've noticed that after I turned 40, my memory started going.
I'm the same. It's horrible.
Yeah. Before I was 40, and I was running a networking organization with groups all over the UK and in Spain. And before I was 40, I could turn up and I would remember someone and they would just be gobsmacked. But they were in context for me. If I'd have bumped into them in the street in a different city, it might have been different. I've lost that ability. But what the ability I do have is if I don't recognize you, but you remind me where we met, I can then remember the conversation. And I think that then impacts. You mentioned this phrase, it's not what you know or who you know.
It's who knows what you know.
And I have my own version of that with it's who knows you and what they know, what they say about you when you're not in the room.
Yes.
And that comes from the really deep relationship.
Well, that's your brand, your personal brand. Often it's said is that personal brand is what people say about you. And I would love to know, I think I do know what some people think about me and others do. Just on that personal branding, how important is that as one of the tactics of this professional networking strategy?
It's hugely important. It's hugely important. One of the biggest examples I use, and it's a transferable example, but the example relates to promotion. And there's a very well-known piece of research that's from the last century, but I think it's still relevant today. And certainly that's the feedback I get in sessions from a guy called Harvey Coleman. And the research is known as PI, because Harvey Coleman looked at the three elements that went into promotion. And the three elements he looked at were performance, image, and exposure. Now, until I found this research, I would get a lot of pushback from audiences when I said, it doesn't matter how good you are at your job, you will not get promoted if you don't have the network, and certainly if you don't have the profile. And people would always fight me on it. But the funny thing was, I could talk to an audience of HR professionals, and I could say, if you have two CVs that are exactly the same, the CVs are the same, their interview skills are the same, exactly the same, one of them is recommended by a member of the team and the other one isn't, which one's going to get the job? And despite all the best intent and all the policies, it's the one with the connection that's going to get hired. But Coleman's research showed that performance, which is where everyone wants to believe the biggest factor in getting a promotion, was 10%. Image, and I would define image in this sense as what people know about what you do, 30%. Exposure, who knows what you do, 60. And if you think about it, you know, it depends on the size of the company and the hierarchical nature of it and the level at which you're looking for the promotion. In many cases, a promotion is not going to be determined by the people who know what you do the best, i.e. your immediate line manager and your peers. They might have influence, sometimes very limited, but it's going to be determined by the level above and probably a committee of people. And if there are nine people on that committee and only one of them knows you and what you do, you may be the best performer in the business, but you're not going to get that promotion. Now, you take that concept and then you put it into a small business who wants to get sales. You may be brilliant at what you deliver, but if people don't know about it and they don't know exactly what it is and what the value is, you're not selling. You can take anything that you want to achieve. People aren't going to support you. Your message may be the best message possible. You know, change management, trying to get everyone on board with a merger, for example. You know, the reasons for the merger might be phenomenal. The security for the employees of the company may actually be increased by the merger. But if people don't really get that, and the key influencers in that workforce, let's say, for example, in a unionized workforce, the reps from the union, if they don't get that, you're not getting the backing of the workforce. So I think that PI formula works really well. Performance is important. Don't get me wrong. That 10% is an influential 10%. Because if your performance is terrible, that's going to influence what people say about you. Yeah. And who knows it. And probably more people will know about the bad performance than the good. So I'm not dismissing performance, but I'm saying personal brand is vital.
But you make a really good point about internal relationships and internal network. When I joined IBM in 2013, my then boss, Matt Candy, said to me, he'd been there a long time, he said, it's actually more important to generate your internal networks than your external. He said, trust me. And so I had to get to know 400,000 people. I was lucky in week three, I was asked to make a presentation to 700 of my peers in a big room. It meant that for even 3 years afterwards, people said, I remember you at Excel on stage doing that. So I was very lucky. I could actually in one go tell 700 people what I did and how I could help them. But for people that don't have that opportunity, how do you develop an internal network in a way that isn't overly, hey, be my friend, but it's actually, you know, nurturing, understanding what you do and how you can help them? What advice do you give people about internal professional relationships?
First of all, it is absolutely vital, as you say. I find more competition within organisations than collaboration. And I'd love to know how much that's costing business in any year. it's phenomenal in terms of lack of cross-referral from the sales perspective, in terms of people not supporting others' projects where they need their input. It's very costly for business. How do you do it? You take the time to build relationships. It's the simple stuff. It's not rushing off. It's not dictating to other departments, I need this from you. It's seeing the other person's perspective. Why would they help you? They've got their own challenges. And I think what happens a lot is people protect their own little area. And if they need someone's support, they insist on it without actually trying to win the other person over. It comes down fundamentally, Dale Carnegie quote, well, there's two. One, I've never been able to pin the source. It was told to me as a Dale Carnegie quote, and it's people are interested in people who are interested in them. And I have never actually been able to find the source of that. But what Dale Carnegie certainly said was the sweetest sound to any man is the sound of his own name. I used to be a civil servant. Not many people know that.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, not a lot of people know. So after I left university, my first two permanent jobs were as a tax collector, Mr. Popular here, and then as a social fund officer. So I worked for the benefits agency. And my job in the benefits agency was, I was the first tier of management. So I led a team. We would receive applications for loans and grants from people, predominantly on benefit, a lot of refugees and asylum seekers because of where we were. And I would have to make a decision on those applications. And now because of budget controls and so on, a lot had to get turned down. And the procedure was that people would come in, submit their application at the reception or by post. I'd make a decision. It would be delivered back through our reception. And then if they didn't like it, often the case, they would be able to ask for a review. The receptionist would determine whether it was a reasonable request for a review or not. Now, I was in my early 20s at the time. I did not like my job. Let's be honest. I'd never heard of networking. There was nothing strategic about what I did, but I found out later it worked. When I went down to reception, one of my best friends in the job was the supervisor at reception. I used to stop and chat to the team there. I knew them all. I had a laugh, a joke. I didn't get on with my own team. I got on really well with the reception team. And in fact, you know, it's quite funny looking at what I went on to do as a public speaker and as someone focused on professional relationships and networks and breaking down silos. We used to open late on Wednesdays for team meetings. I instigated, I would go to other teams and tell them what we were up to. And I never got into this space at that point. But I used to invest, as I look at it now, invest in the relationships with the reception team. Now, that friend of mine, we lost touch when I left that job. I went off traveling to Australia. I lost touch with a lot of people. It's before email and Facebook and so on. But 20 years later, we sort of got back in touch again. In fact, I'll be seeing her in a few weeks. But when we first caught up again after years, she told me that her team used to protect me from reviews. So they would, wherever it was reasonable, they would fight my call and they'd say, sorry, this is a fair decision. There's no review. So they protect me, my team, and our time. My colleagues who used to walk down there just slap down a decision and go, right, give them this and walk out again and never talk and invest in the relationships with that reception team. Guess what happened? Yeah. You want a review? Of course you can. So you had a team there that was supporting me and making my life easier because I invested in relationships with them. And they were actually obstructing my colleagues because they didn't. And I think that's a simple answer.
I've got a similar story, and I realize now back in 1997, I was also practicing professional relationship building. I'll give you the quick story. So I was a project lead on a large data network run by Optus in Australia. We're building the first ATM and frame relay network, and that dates me because we don't talk about that anymore. It's worth $47 million. But the team that I was working with, none of them reported to me. We had HR and engineering and finance, and none of them reported to me. And we had a meeting every 2 p.m. on a Thursday. And they didn't all have to come. But what I started doing was learning about what they like to do outside the office. So I remember John Lynn used to like going sailing. So before the meeting would start, hi, John, did you go sailing on the weekend? And then what happened, as we got some press on the project, I would bring the press clippings in and give it to them. And they would take it home and show their spouse or their friends. I found that everyone wanted to work on my project, not because it was the best project or I was the best project manager. They actually liked being there. And when you're in a matrix organization where you can't dictate what they do, it was actually because they liked the environment. And I realize now the same thing technique you used, I didn't know that I was doing it. I was just doing it because that's what I do. And I knew how to develop a team. And often when I'm in a job situation, they say, you know, describe something you did. I tell this story and I think, why is that unique? Isn't that what everyone does?
It's amazing how many people don't. And this is the thing about what I teach. It's simple. I was a 23-year-old, straight out of uni, and probably doing this because I didn't particularly enjoy my job and I was just trying to get the best out of it. But I was employing very effective relationship building techniques. And I'll put my hands up. I didn't manage that everywhere in my job. Within my team and with my direct colleagues, I was terrible. You know, and as a line manager, I was really poor. I just didn't have that skill set at that time. But that was a straightforward, simple thing for me to do. Not everyone's like that. Some people are head down, do the job. Similar thing. They may not like their job, but they will go in and do what they need to do and get out.
But you'd argue that's what an introvert stereotypically is like. So is it easier for extroverts like you and I to do the business networking? And how would you encourage an introvert to do this? Because if it's so valuable, they might be missing out.
It's a really good question. And it's one of the most common questions I get asked. In fact, I've got a couple of videos on YouTube on this topic, and they probably get more views than most of my other videos. So it's a key one out there. And it's a really interesting one as well. For a start, I would no longer classify myself as extrovert. I think when I was younger, I had more extrovert tendencies. As I've got older, as I have attended so many networking events and meetings and so forth, I enjoy my own time and space a lot more. And, you know, extroverts charge up through engaging with other people. Introverts recharge by being on their own. I actually do both. But I would say, given the choice, I need balance.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if I'm, if I have, I think recently I had 10 or 11 evenings where I didn't go out and I was at home and I was going nuts. This week I'm out Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. You know, it's too much. So I need a balance. So I think the term is an ambivert.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But back to the question. The funny thing is that introverts on the whole are better suited to network than extroverts.
Really?
And here's why. Yes, an introvert will find it harder, particularly in a big event or a conference. I think an introvert, if you say networking is going for lunch with a colleague, it's going out with three or four people, you know, and just having a conversation, it's engaging in a web forum. Those are all channels to build relationships which introverts are comfortable with. So the first thing is to change your definition of networking and say, if you get paralyzed by going into a conference or a room full of strangers, unless it is a core part of your job, find different ways of doing it. Ask your existing network to make introductions. The only time that doesn't work is when you don't have an existing network and you've just got to get out there and do it. Yeah. But what equips introverts to be better networkers and relationship builders is the ability to listen. An extrovert will talk and predominantly about themselves. An introvert will listen, will engage and will ask questions and will actually listen to the answers and digest them and base their response on that. Those are great skills for anyone building relationships to have. So for introverts, I would say you do network. You just don't label it as such. You are very well equipped to do so. Just choose your channel.
Yeah, good advice. I know we don't want to sort of go down the networking path, but I just want to ask you a question. So more recently, when I meet someone for the first time in an event, two things happen. There's some free advice. Whenever you've got a badge or a lanyard, put it as high as you can for two reasons. One is it then looks different. So I wear my badge on my lapel. It's very high. People go, oh, that's different. And I put the practical futurist on there, which opens the discussion. What's a practical futurist? And for the females listening, have it as high as possible because you don't want people looking in inappropriate places.
And wear it on the right-hand side. Most people will wear their badge on their left.
Okay.
Now, when you shake hands, that actually blocks the view. But you do it because you're right-handed.
Yeah.
So that's the natural thing to do.
So then what I have changed doing, I would say, what do you do or where are you from? And often that can be misconstrued. I'm from Cambodia. Or no. I actually say, so why are you famous? And it throws them because no one's ever asked that. I then say, you can make it up. And it lowers the guard because they think, oh, what can I say? And I've done that deliberately to be disarming. And then what I do is I listen. And they tell me more about themselves and their company because they feel like this isn't someone trying to trap me. They want to hear a story. And it seems to really work. So what's your opening line when you meet someone?
Well, I always say I can't stand the line, what do you do? And I always say it's the networking equivalent of, do you come here often? and my answer to your question is, do you come here often? I don't use those words because your laugh sort of gives it away. It's misconstrued for something else. But what we're looking for is something we have in common.
Yes.
If we find common ground, then conversation is easier. We Brits are famous for talking about the weather and the travel. Why do we do it? Because we know it's the one thing we share if we're at the same event. If you go to an event hosted by me, the number one opening question is going to be, how do you know Andy? If you go to a conference, you can say, have you been to this to the conference before? Or any event, have you been before? Or do you come here regularly? And either way it goes, it gives you a channel for further conversation. So when you say, what do you do? And someone replies and says, I'm a data analyst, or I'm a solicitor, or I'm an actuary, I'm estate agent. It could be anything. If you're not interested in that, your response tends to be, oh, that's nice. When you say, have you been to this event before? If they say, no, it's my first time. Oh, what brought you here? Oh, yeah, I come every year. Oh, really? So what brings you here? So it leads to an open conversation. Mm. If you're at an event where there are speakers, what did you think of that last speaker? What's your highlight so far? So for me, asking something like that feels natural. It's not contrived. It's not taking you down a conversational cul-de-sac, which is what do you do does. And you can then follow it through from there.
I was on your website during the week preparing for this podcast, and I came across the Professional Relationships Wheel. Now, this is an audio medium, so I will put a link to the diagram in the show notes. But if you can imagine, it's a wheel, and it asks a bunch of questions. I imagine you've developed it so you can actually score where you need to improve. And I'll give you some examples. You know, how strong are your existing professional relationships? In which areas do you lack the relationships you need? How good are you at keeping in touch with the network? Does your network support you as much as they could? So why did you develop the wheel, and how can people use it if they go and download it?
Well, I've been using wheels of that nature for quite a long time, actually. The way I use it is, before I'm running a workshop or working with a mentoring client, I'll send it out in advance. It's really to get the people who are going to be working with me to think about where their challenges are and where I can most support them. Also on the training, I will say, okay, now go away and work out. Where do you most need to improve? And I have several wheels. So I have a vulnerability wheel because my new book is about asking for help. I have a referrals wheel for sales-focused networks and relationships. So what we're trying to identify is, what are your biggest challenges? On the relationship wheel, it's split into three areas. They're the three areas of relationships that I focus on, and that's building, nurturing, and leveraging. So that you'll see it's in three colors, and there are five questions in each. So it can be adapted. You know, if I'm working with a particular industry or particular client where they have a specific need, then the questions might change related to where they are. In terms of how people can use that, if you put that in the show notes and people download it, you shade in your answers. Zero is in the center, and that means, oh my God, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never considered that. One of the questions is how active are you on social media? If you're not, don't have a profile on any of them, you'd shade in zero. If you are on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, Zing, Rise, carry on, you know, then you're going to shade in towards the outer circle, 10 out of 10. There are two questions I ask my groups. The first question is, what are the three areas in which you're strongest and why? Now, I've already alluded to the fact that what I teach is very often something we do naturally all the time. But if we can understand what we do well naturally, and we understand why we do that well, what it is we do well, we can do two things with it. One, we can do more of the same. And two, we can teach other people so we can replicate. What you find with a lot of organizations is that there will be a leader, whether it's a CEO in a smaller business, whether it's a sales director, for example, or a board member in a larger business, they're brilliant at professional relationships. That's why they are where they are. But the result of that is their team delegate all the relationship-related activity to them. So all the referral activity, all of the supplier relationships, all of the influencer relationships are delegated up to that key person. Now, that's no good for the business if that person leaves. It's no good for that person because they've got a job to do themselves. And it's no good for the individuals on their teams. It doesn't bring them forward into leadership positions themselves. So if that leader can identify why they're good at it and others aren't, they can then teach those skills. Or, of course, bring in someone to do it, hint, hint. The second question for groups is, what are the three areas you most want to improve and what are you going to do about it? And my key piece of advice on that is it's not necessarily the three that you've scored the lowest. It could be three that you've scored almost the highest, but they are essential. So you're better moving an 8 to a 9 or 10 than moving a 0 to a 3. There are reasons why you're at 0, 1 or 2. And it may be that's not relevant to you. It's not important to you. It may be that's not natural for you. So let's go back to our introverts. If there's a question about going to networking events and you're paralyzed with fear when you go and it's not essential, that's not necessarily an area you need to improve. Move on. Don't try and move a 3 to a 4 instead of an 8 to a 10.
Good point. You mentioned the book. I'd love to have you back on another podcast to talk about that because that goes beyond the relationships and asking for help, I think, is a whole other topic. So love to have you back for that. Sure. But before we close, and because this is the Practical Futurist podcast, what three things can our listeners do this week to develop an effective professional relationship strategy?
Three things you could do this week is, I think, number one is analyze where your existing relationships are and where the gaps are. So I on my workshops, I ask the delegates to map out their network, which is a bit of a pain, you know, it's a bit of hard work, but people are finding it incredibly powerful, personal and professional. So both, you know, everyone you know, and map them out by, what I suggest people do is categorize people by how you know them. So you might say we're both members of the Professional Speaking Association, so you would put PSA as a strand. Now, if you put PSA as a strand on your network, Andrew, you will think of people that you wouldn't have thought of if I just said map out the people you know. If you go to different PSA regions, so let's say you go to London, Thames Valley and Midlands. If you put a different branch for each and said, who do I know in London? Who do I know in Thames Valley? Who do I know in Midlands? You're going to think of people you hadn't have thought of when you just thought of PSA. So distill it down. Then when you've got each person listed, just your technique, some notes about them. Who do they work for? What industry? What's their expertise? What do they like? What are they interested in? So that when you need to find the right person, it's all there mapped out for you. Because we know, going back to the Dunbar number, how many people can we remember at one time? Now, we'll know a lot more people and we'll have engaged with a lot more people than we can remember at one time, that 150. So therefore, the network map is a tool to just look and remind ourselves, oh my God, I didn't think of that person, but they're perfect for this. So we went to the rugby. I would put Andrew likes rugby, and when I get tickets for the rugby, who have I got who likes rugby? So that's the first thing. The second thing, I have something called the 3-I pie. I believe that if you take any particular project you're working on, if there are three types of people you need professional relationships with, and they are influencers, introducers and sources of information, ideas and insight. So for any project, you can say, okay, who are the key stakeholder groups on this project? So it might be my people across my organization. It might be people in my industry, might be people in the client's industry, it might be people in the client's organization. Now, who are the introducers? Who are the influencers? Who are the people who are going to give me information, ideas and insight? Who do I know? How can they help me in those three areas? And you can start to identify, A, where the gaps in your network are, and B, where your resources are and you haven't considered them already. So it helps you engage your network and your relationships in helping you achieve that product project far more effectively. And then the third thing is get out your phone, get out LinkedIn, go through your emails, pick six people who you haven't spoken to in over 6 months, but you should have done, and pick up the phone. Let's say in the next week, five people, one a day. Pick up the phone to one person a day who you haven't spoken to and you should have done with no agenda. You pick up the phone and say, hey, we haven't talked for a while. I've just been thinking about you. What's happening? You might get their voicemail. If they're busy, people get their voicemail. It doesn't matter. It's a touch point. You're reaching out, but The golden rule about nurturing relationships is that 90% of follow-up should be about them, not about you. So don't wait till you need them before you reach out and contact them. So phone one person a day and then carry it on next week and then the week after, then the week after.
Such good tips. Andy, how can people find out more about you and your work?
With a name like mine, I'm easy to find, as long as you can spell it. So my website is lopata.co.uk, lopata.co.uk, and I'm sure that'll be in the show notes. On social media, you can find me easily by my name. There's over 100 videos on YouTube. On LinkedIn, if you want to reach out, please personalise the connection request. Tell me how you came across me.
Just say you listen to the podcast.
Exactly. And certainly follow me on LinkedIn, because I put a lot of content on there. Twitter, Andy Lopata, facebook.com/networkingstrategy. I'm all over social media. There is on my website, there are a number of free resources, and I've got a 3-weekly e-zine that people can sign up to on the website, where I put in a video tip. We're doing at the moment the A to Z of mentoring, masterminding and asking for help, which is crowdsourced. So that every 3 weeks I'll go to my network and say, okay, we're on C. What are your C's in mentoring, masterminding and asking for help? I mean, I had 30 responses for C. I've had to edit it down brutally. And that's going to be in two parts. But that's a really popular piece. And then there's a video tip. There's a bit of fun in there and maybe a simple tip or other resources.
Andy, I've really enjoyed our chat. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to the Practical Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at futurist.london. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops at futurist.london. Until next time, this has been the Practical Futurist Podcast.